Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough, and today on the program, Doug Owens turns up the heat with his own attack ads aimed at Mia Love. Utah Transit Authority Chairman H. David Burton steps down as the agency struggles to keep its commitment to be transparent. John Huntsman Jr. says that he disagrees with Donald Trump on a range of issues, but will vote for him anyway. And you're probably familiar with the Zion Curtain, but what about the Zion Ceiling? Plus tension between Salt Lake City Mayor Jackie Biskupski and the City Council over new homeless shelters, what's happening at the Salt Lake County Recorder's Office, and various other stories on the show today. Joining me in the studio this morning, Salt Lake Tribune government editor Dan Harry. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning.
Arts and culture reporter Kathy Stevenson. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Government and transportation reporter Lee Davidson. Thanks for being here as well.
Thank you.
And Salt Lake Tribune editorial writer Paul Raleigh. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning.
Listeners, however you're tuning in, you can join the conversation with your comments and questions at sltrib.com. or by calling us up at 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. All right, a lot of news to cover this week. Government editor Dan Harry, let's kick the show off with some news about former Utah Governor John Huntsman Jr., who is sticking by a primary season pledge to support the GOP nominee. John Huntsman Jr. says that he will vote for Donald Trump.
Right. He made comments that he doesn't really like either nominee, which we hear a lot of these days. But he said on the issues, he believes that he's closer to Donald Trump. The ones he cited were taxes, business regulations. He even mentioned public lands. And like many Republicans, he talked about Supreme Court appointments. And that, Donald Trump, to kind of reassure the conservative base, has released this list. He calls it a short list that he promises if he makes a Supreme Court appointee as president, it will come from that list. And it actually includes two Utahns, Thomas and Mike Lee.
Wow.
It's
pretty amazing. And so the Supreme Court issue being one that is, kind of giving people enough reason to vote for him despite these disagreements. I mean, Huntsman pointed out that he doesn't agree with him on all a range of issues. And this actually comes as a surprise to a lot of people because Huntsman was, of course, President Obama's ambassador mm-hmm. to China and has been seen as a more moderate Republican.
And Hillary Clinton was his boss.
Right.
When he was ambassador to China, Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State. So she was his boss. And at the time, he praised both of them, Obama and Clinton, very highly as very competent leaders and professionals.
And then add to the mix something that we've discussed in a lot on the show, the fact that Trump has had some difficulties with Utahns generally. Is this, I guess, endorsement? It's hard, again, to answer this question, but do you think it'll have much of an effect? And maybe we should turn to Paul Raleigh for that one. But
yeah, go ahead, Paul.
The one thing that Trump's got going for him in Utah is the fact that most Utahns hate Hillary Clinton more than they hate Trump. Hmm. And so that's the choice. And John Huntsman now has come down on the side of Trump because he's leading in Utah and he's probably going to win Utah, even though a lot of voters will hold their nose. Who knows what John Huntsman's, future is and motivations. There are a lot of rumors about Republicans running against Orrin Hatch if he so chooses to run again in 2018, and John Huntsman's name pops up on that. So maybe this is a safe choice for him. But it's interesting because, kind of turning to the right on this to say that he's endorsing and voting for Trump. Kind of flies in the face of what he was like as governor. He was a very moderate governor.
Hmm. So maybe some kind of ulterior motives possibly there. In this email that he wrote, Dan Harry, he singled out economic issues. Campaign finance reform was another one in addition to the Supreme Court
right.
issue.
He talked about a few of those issues. Paul's right, though. This is definitely going to stir speculation that we'll see John Huntsman Jr. back here running for the Senate. He certainly hasn't addressed that issue, but if you were keeping that option open, this seems like something you'd want to do to get the Republican nomination. The surprising thing about John Huntsman Jr. is he probably was more popular with Democrats than Republicans in Utah. And this certainly is not pleasing them. I mean, I see some, on some of the comment boards that they do not like this endorsement by Huntsman.
Well, and here's a question for you is actually, could it have the opposite effect? I mean, you're saying that it may be an appeal to the right, but then you do, again, as we've said, in Utah have that that group of people who are not Trump, you know, champions.
Right. Like Paul said, you know, if history holds true, they're going to vote for the Republican nominee in Utah. But our recent poll showed that neither one of them, Trump or Clinton, are close to a majority support in the polls right now.
What is it? The Tribune-Hinckley poll was a 9-point?
There was a 9-point difference. But, you know, the I think Trump was like in the mid-30s of folks who said that they were going to vote for him. So you saw a lot of people, I think, in the 20s. Say that they were going to vote for the Libertarian candidate, Gary Johnson. You saw double-digit numbers for Evan McMullen, the independent candidate. So it'll be interesting come election day to see how that shapes up.
And I think, I mean, just to go back to the Tribune-Hinckley poll showing that 9-point differential, that's a tighter margin than we've seen in previous polls. Is that correct?
Yeah, we had a poll, I think it was back in June, that actually showed them neck and neck. But there have been subsequent polls to that that have showed a much wider spread. Yeah, so this 9-point spread seems to be closing.
It's a tighter poll, but if you look at Hillary Clinton's numbers, her numbers are consistent with other Democrats, Democratic presidential candidates in Utah. Her number is still very low. The reason it's tighter is because of these other candidates who are getting pretty good support in Utah.
Okay. Wow. And again, Gary Johnson and Evan McMullen being those other candidates. A quick reminder to listeners that you can join this conversation. What does John Huntsman Jr.'s endorsing Trump mean to you? Call us at 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. And, you know, 38 days till Election Day. Other races out there are, of course, also intensifying. In the race for Utah's 4th district House seat, Mia Love has been running some pretty strong, you know, they're called attack ads against challenger Doug Owens. This week, Owens kind of struck back. And Dan Harry, can you tell us what's going on in that race?
Yeah, so it was kind of curious. Polls have shown that Mia Love has a pretty comfortable lead in the 4th district over Doug Owens. And she came out with the first negative ad, which is kind of really runs against the traditional thought that if you're ahead, you stay nice. Mm-hmm. And if you're losing or if you're behind, then you come out attacking. But she ran the first attack ad. And, you know, it was about Legacy Highway. I don't know if their polling shows that that has traction or not. There's a lot of people who actually like the Legacy Highway, but the ad attacks Owens for filing a lawsuit that led to long delays in the construction.
And, over environmental concerns.
Right. Extra money. But it did end up with some things that I think people like, which is, you know, fewer lanes, no truck traffic. That may be a mixed message. But so Owens came out with his negative ad this week, and it's kind of like he did 2 years ago, sort of attacking her for being in Washington to serve herself. And he put out an ad, and the Love people quickly responded with their own negative ad. And the mailboxes have been really stuffed with Doug Owens attack pieces on Mia Love. It's been just a flood since he ran that first TV ad earlier this week.
And you hinted at something, which is that 2 years back, he was maybe a little bit more on the aggressive.
Right.
And this is maybe a turn towards what he was doing those 2 years
ago. Right. And, you know, with the poll showing that he's got quite a distance to catch up to her, that makes sense. How much he can really dig into that is an unknown this time. You know, the election's really not that far away because we have by-mail voting. We have early voting. So a lot of people are not going to wait till November 8th to cast their ballot. It's, you know, it's going to start pretty soon here.
This is essentially the final stretch right here.
It is.
So some kind of mudslinging going on. Polling from last week or the week before, as you said, showed Love with a pretty strong advantage.
Yeah, we had an 18-point spread in that race. So that's higher than other recent polls have shown. A little surprised about that. Yeah. We actually, again, had a poll back in June that showed Doug Owens slightly ahead. So I don't know what's going on. Maybe we've got some polls that are questionable, or maybe there are some things changing in that district. I also noticed that 2 years ago, Mila had very high unfavorable ratings, and those have improved considerably this year. And I don't know if Doug Owens Kemp is banking on the fact that she was there once, very, very high unapproval ratings. Maybe they can get back to that with negative ads.
With negative ads. And is, I mean, obviously, that's what he's hoping for, is to see, you know, is that this tactic will change the game for him here in this final hour.
Yeah, and I think that race is negative from here on out. I don't think it goes back to being nice.
Okay, well, trying to move the needle there in the next 38 days, as I said, before Election Day. Although, as you pointed out, so many ballots already in the mail, and I'm sure that I don't know.
I think the ballots get sent out. Lee probably knows this better than me, but get sent out
week
in the next
of October 11th. So we're
October 11th. So it's coming up quickly.
That is a nice clean fight. It's not going to be. listeners, there's still a little bit more in the way of politics to discuss on the show coming up next. The debate between Michael Weinholz and Utah Governor Gary Herbert. You are tuned to Behind the Headlines on KCPW in the Greater Salt Lake Valley and throughout the state on Utah Public Radio. We're going to take one quick 1 minute break and we'll be right back.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and USU Partners in Business, 42nd Annual Operational Excellence Conference, striving for organizational excellence through continuous improvement and creative engagement, October 11th and 12th. Details at partners.usu.edu.
Florida is a battleground state every 4 years. This year, though, there are going to be some extra voters.
We don't have a voice, and the Puerto Ricans that are here, actually, at least I have a voice over there. They don't.
I'm Kai Rizdal. The Puerto Rican economy and this election, that is next time on Marketplace.
Join us tonight at 6:30 on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines, the Salt Lake Tribune Reporter News Roundup, heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough, joined in the studio by the Salt Lake Tribune's Dan Harry, Lee Davidson, Kathy Stevenson, and Paul Raleigh. Listeners, you can join the conversation commenting at the Behind the Headlines page, currently live at sltrib.com, or by calling us up at 801-355-TALK. Going back to you, Government Editor Dan Harry, sticking with politics for a little bit longer, there was a gubernatorial debate between Mike Weinholz and Governor Herbert just ahead of the presidential debate on Monday, and the candidates drew sharp contrasts between each other on a variety of policy issues. How did this debate play out?
Well, a lot of folks thought that Mike Weinholz, the Democrat, came out a lot stronger this time. He kind of went on the offensive. The first time they met in the debate, he was sort of laid back, and he got some criticism for that. That, you know, he's got a lot of ground to make up. 30-40 point gap there. So that's a huge thing to make up. And so he has to be aggressive. He did come out more aggressively in this last debate, which probably was their last debate.
And he called Herbert kind of a career politician.
I think 26 years in public office. He also criticized him, you know, again, for campaign fundraising. He held that meeting in the Alta Club and met with the lobbyists and tried to say that he would be available for the big donors anytime, anywhere.
Right.
And also on public lands issues, Mike Weinholz has been very critical of Utah, the legislature, and the governor being willing to spend up to $14 million to sue the federal government to try to take control of federal lands. And Weinholz basically says that's a fantasy. That will never happen. It's a waste of money. Our money would be better spent elsewhere. And education has been one of his big issues. He said we are continuing to underfund education, that we're the last in the nation for per pupil spending. Governor Herbert came to our editorial board meeting yesterday and in that said that he will include about another $400 million in new money for education in his budget, which comes out in December. And
was that something that he had planned? Is that, I mean, people talk about election year initiatives to try and, but Herbert's not in the kind of a vulnerable position to have to.
No, he's not. And that sounds kind of in line with what he's done the last few years as the economy's picked up. He has been trying to get more of the money devoted to education. Although critics point out that, you know, if you go back over the last 10, 15 years, the percentage of the budget that goes to public education, kindergarten through 12, has actually shrunk from what it was 15 years ago, say.
Okay, so they differed on public lands policy, education. Mm-hmm. I know Medicaid expansion was another one that
they battled
over. We've kind of laid out Mike Weinholz coming out on the attack. What was Governor Gary Herbert pointing to for his own successes?
Well, his defense number one is the economy. You know, Utah gets very good ratings for job creation here, for unemployment. Lee had a story earlier this week about getting high marks for personal income growth. So, you know, there are a lot of things about the economy that are going in the right direction in Utah. And that's basically the governor's number one defense and the number one thing that he points to in his platform.
Again, listeners, if you watched this debate between Mike Weinholz and Governor Gary Herbert, we'd love to hear your thoughts on how it went. Give us a call, 801-355-8255, or comment at sltrib.com. Paul Raleigh, did you watch this debate?
I did not, but I do have a comment, you know, and that is all the issues that Dan just laid out and Weinholz's arguments and what he can do to attack Gary Herbert, it sort of doesn't matter. It just shows, you know, that we live in a state with one-party domination, and you see everything settling in now for the Republicans in the Love Owens race. And you know, you look at the Herbert race, and you would think he would be vulnerable on certain things. He has a meeting, as Dan mentioned, with lobbyists where he basically said he'll meet with them for a big campaign contribution and the speed dating thing, and he'd be available Jones for them.
Well, and essentially turn the administration of his government over to
others, to his chief of staff and his lieutenant governor, while he goes out and fundraises. There was the story of a few years ago of the state UDOT paying $13 million to a company that thought they had the bid for the big highway project down in Utah County, and then they lost it to a company that had given Herbert a lot of donations. You would think that that would stick, but it doesn't. And it just shows, I think, you know, what you can get away with in Utah as a Republican.
I also think there's something about the office of governor in Utah that, you know, going back, and Paul's covered politics longer than I have, and that's an awful long time. So you go back, you know, decades, and we have always had popular governors here. There's something about that office that it's, I guess, an individual that gets a lot of attention, but huge popularity ratings for our governors, Democrat and Republican.
The last, to make Dan's point,
Paul Raleigh, no.
The last incumbent governor in Utah to lose his bid for reelection was Charles Mabee in 1924.
Wow.
Well, Olean Walker, but she
didn't make it through the convention, right. But I mean in a general election.
Okay, so somebody who is defending there in the general election. That's 1924. That's a long time. So, but again, the polls right now, of course, favor that. They show that that's the tendency, the likelihood in this upcoming election.
Yeah. One race that hasn't gotten a lot of attention, but I think could be a real interesting one come election night, is the Richard Snellgrove, Catherine Cantor race on the county council. And the reason that that could be real interesting is because Catherine Cantor, who's got a lot of money and is doing a lot of ads and campaigning, and Richard Snellgrove, the incumbent Republican, not so much, is that if she won that seat, the Democrats would take over control of the county council. So.
You know, to that point, too, the Democrats blew a a possible great opportunity to pick up a seat, too, because Michael Jensen on the county council, I mean, he's just gone through kind of a scandal about his, you know, his compensation and his bonuses and all that, and it led to him having to resign as fire chief. But the Democrats didn't even run a candidate against him.
It was an unopposed race. That's pretty amazing. Listeners, we want to hear your thoughts on all of the election news that's happening right now. This is the final stretch, the final 38 days before voting day. 801-359-5279. Dan, Harry, when it comes to Herbert and Weinholz, is that it for their debates?
I believe so. I mean, Weinholz wants more debates. Gary Herbert, the incumbent, doesn't. You know, the old saying is that if you're far ahead, you have nothing to gain in a debate and everything to lose. One major misstep could really cost you some votes. So I doubt that we'll see them back on the debate stage together.
Okay. You know, we do have one. Let's see. Actually, hold on a second. Let's turn to a non-politics story, if there is such a thing out there anymore. Dan, Harry, Salt Lake City and Salt Lake County want to build two 250-bed homeless shelters. And these are in, as of yet, undisclosed locations. But as Christopher Smart reported, the Salt Lake City Council wants to weigh in on both the locations and the numbers of these shelters, but they're finding doing so a little bit difficult. What's going on with that?
Yeah, what's going on here is I think people are working on two different tracks. The mayor of Salt Lake City, the mayor of Salt Lake County, the legislature, all are pushing toward these alternate shelters. And as you said, about 250 beds apiece compared to the current shelter at the Rio Grande, which is about 900 to 1,000 beds. Hmm. And their idea is that you put these smaller facilities, you spread them out. You don't have them in one location like they all are now, where we see this tremendous homeless problem that we see in downtown Salt Lake, and that you focus more services there, that you locate to, you know, some screeners for medical services, for job services and those kinds of things, and caseworkers, and help those folks that are in the shelter.
Right.
So it sounds like a good idea. The legislature's willing to put up some money for it, has put up the first installment. The problem is the city council, which represents districts in the city, wants to make sure that these don't end up in their districts, especially in neighborhoods. The uproar we're sure to hear if there's a 250-bed homeless shelter in a anywhere near a residential area is going to be deafening.
Not in my backyard. It's kind of
absolutely.
And this comes back to a question about the fact that they are 250-bed shelters. Why we talked about dispersed sites. Two 250-bed shelters doesn't sound too dispersed. It sounds concentrated.
It does sound concentrated. It's a fairly large facility. It's comparable to the facility in Ogden, the homeless shelter there. But the reason they did that was because with the resources available, that was the most efficient use of the money, they thought. And the city council wants other priorities put ahead, just, you know, how best to use those dollars. If it takes more money, they say, let's find the money. They're also mad at the mayor because they feel like they've been cut out of the process. And actually this morning, the city council is having a news conference. I'm sure it's something to do with this issue. I don't know what the complaint is, but they feel like they've been cut out of the loop on it.
Hmm. Okay. And the state legislature, as you said, has put money behind this initiative, did that during the last legislative session. And they want to see progress being made as well.
Right. That was the first installment, and they're kind of holding the rest of the money hostage, saying, look, if you don't show us that you're actually serious about this and start getting underway on these things, you're not going to get the rest of the money. And that's why there is this sort of urgency to get some approval, get the site locations, and get moving on this before the legislative session starts in January.
And the city, meanwhile, has said, look, we've had conversations that involved the city council. We've had, all of the conversations we've had till now have been about this. It's just you haven't been participating. I mean, what is their response to the sort of criticism from the city council?
They claim that they do want to involve the city council. The mayor tried to hold a closed-door meeting with the city council a few days ago, and they refused to do it because I believe the idea was that she wanted to have them know what the locations are, not the final locations, but the ones under consideration, and have input on those. And they want to make sure this is a decision that the locations that come out as they come out publicly are the mayor's picks, not theirs. They want to make it clear they didn't pick these sites, but they're also criticizing her for being left out of the process. They're saying that this is kind of the 11th hour that she's coming in and trying to include them.
Dan Harry, government editor of the Salt Lake Tribune there. Paul Raleigh, 250 bed locations. Again, as I said, it doesn't sound as dispersed. And actually, I'm wondering if maybe the political reality of going into communities and if you have to negotiate with a wider number of communities is playing a hand there, too, that limiting to two conversations with municipalities is easier than having to do a greater one. But I guess if you live in a neighborhood and you're worried about property values and so on, this is something that you might actually object to.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if they, as Dan said, if they put it anywhere near any residential areas, they're going to get a lot of flack. No wonder the city council wants to make sure that, you know, the mayor takes the blame for it wherever it goes. You know, the homeless situation in Salt Lake is just so out of control right now that I don't know what they can do to fix it.
Hmm. Well, there's something I want to get to, another news item that's kind of related to that, I think. But Dan Harry, finally, when might we be able to expect, what a strange question, but when might we know where these shelters are going?
Well, the proposal from the mayor and her site selection committee should be made public within the next few weeks here. And that's when the uproar really will start.
Yeah. Well, a kind of related story from yesterday morning and having to do with Paul's comment just right then, when there was a surprise raid by police on drug trafficking in and around Salt Lake's Rio Grande district, and an unusual processing of the people who were kind of rounded up from that raid. Dan Harry, tell us.
Right. And this has been in the planning stages, I guess, since June.
Wow.
But it's a joint effort between Salt Lake City and Salt Lake County. And they had police go in mass, go through. They had targeted folks in the homeless population. They had, you know, names, and they went and targeted these folks that they are suspected drug dealers and suspected drug addicts. And then they took them all, instead of taking them straight to jail, they took them to a sort of staging area, and they took each one by one, and took 90 minutes to assess them and say, you know, are they drug addicts? Would they be willing to go into treatment? If so, they would not go to jail. If they were drug dealers and they looked at their criminal history, they were going to go to jail.
Right.
And there were some guarantees by the district attorney, by the sheriff, by the police, that they would not just be booked into jail and then kicked out a few hours later, as we've seen over and over again.
Right.
They would spend some time in jail if they are, in fact, charged with drug dealing.
It sounds like quite the coordinated effort.
The coordinated effort, and it's an experiment. They admitted this is an experiment. This is not going to solve the problem, but they want to do this at least once more, maybe multiple times more, to try to wean out what they see as the bad element in the homeless population to try to get control back. And we've seen a mounting pressure by the business community. Jason Mathis from the Downtown Alliance. We've seen Scott Anderson writing op-ed pieces. We even saw Pamela Atkinson criticizing the loss of control and the chaos that's gone down there in the Rio Grande district.
Well, we have a comment here. We have actually a caller calling in right now with a comment related, I think, to actually the sighting of the homeless shelters. And this is Dr. Sally Amina of Salt Lake. Thanks for calling in. Hello, are you there?
Yes, I am here. My name is pronounced Salih.
Salih, excuse me. Dr. Sally Amina from Salt Lake calling in. Thank you very much for that correction. What's your comment?
You know, I've discussed this with the mayor, and I'm very, very concerned about the homeless issue. I do live downtown. Some of us who live downtown in these very modern buildings, we're paying pretty pricey rents. And when we drive just a few streets away from our homes, we find wall-to-wall, like a square mile, of homeless people sleeping on the streets. We have received in Salt Lake a $127 million grant. And what I find quite disgusting is the money grab that happens immediately with contractors and organizations wanting to get pieces of these funds. And typically what occurs is they build these lovely little, what they call transitional housing complexes, mm-hmm. accent on little. And although they look very nice and they eat huge quantities of money, they house a very, very minuscule portion of the homeless populace.
Doctor,
so if they're housing 10 people or 10 families, that doesn't take care of the 5,000 people on the streets. Hmm. And I would love to see a little more attention on actually solving the problem and a little less tension on let's make money off of this.
Right. Okay. So this is Dr. Amina. That's the construction of these things and the amount of money that goes into project development is money being wasted in your mind.
Very, very. Absolutely. I'm adamant about that issue. Okay. My background is really very strong in finance. I was an international investment advisor for the majority of my career. I'm now retired. My youngest is here in his last year of law school at the U. Okay. I have very strong ties to Utah, and I believe very strongly in we must solve this problem immediately.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you very much for your comment, Dr. Amina, and I appreciate it. And I don't know, Paul Raleigh or Dan Harry, this is interesting, the idea that, you know, that these kinds of projects where you are spending money on, say, you know, transition centers that are small but have a lot of money going into them is money being poorly spent that maybe ought to go into more projects like this kind of treatment that we're seeing done in this I don't want to call it a raid, but this operation from yesterday morning.
Well, I think the caller expressed the sentiment of a lot of people that, you know, if they drive down into this area, it is a shock the first time you see it. I had my son and wife downtown a couple of weeks ago, and we live in the suburbs. And I drove them down Fifth West so they could see, and they literally were in shock. It is kind of like driving through a refugee camp. Unfortunately, you're not going to solve this problem immediately. I know people want it solved now. They want it solved today. That's not going to happen. This is a very intractable problem, and it's going to take a long time, a lot of money, and a lot of smart people figuring out how to do it. It will not be solved quickly at all.
I spent a day a couple of years ago with the head of the metro unit in the Salt Lake City Police Department, and his full-time job was taking care of the homeless and dealing with all that.
Yeah.
And he said to me that the problem that they have is, you know, they're law enforcement officers, but now they've turned into social workers, and they spend a lot of time trying to help these people get into housing, trying to get them jobs, doing everything else. And he felt that the city had sort of dropped the ball on that and turned the social work jobs or responsibilities over to the police.
Well, going back to this operation from yesterday, there were treatment centers, behavioral health was involved, detox centers, ongoing counseling. If that model works, and if there's you know, if that's actually something that seems to have an impact, are there plans to continue?
There are plans, but again, this is an experiment, and it costs money. I mean, this was over $1 million that they're investing because they had to guarantee that there would be treatment beds for these drug addicts. And that's a long-term process, you know, several months, very expensive, and they also had to guarantee that there were jail cells that were going to be left open to hold the folks they were taking to jail, because if you just arrest somebody and release them, that's no threat.
Okay. Well, you know, taking the behavioral health aspect of policing out of the maybe it shouldn't be a policeman's job to have to do that, Paul Raleigh. And we're going to have to take actually a quick break. It's an interesting coordinated effort and some great reporting by Matt Cannon that you can find at sltrib.com. Listeners, when we come back, the so-called Zion Curtain gets a sibling in the Zion ceiling, plus changes at UTA. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stay with us.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and the USU Kane College of the Arts 2016 Convocation with Ann Muir Baker, Director of Music and Opera for the National Endowment for the Arts, Tuesday, October 4th at 7 p.m. in the Kane Performance Hall. More information at cca.usu.edu.
Hey, it's Luke Burbank. This week on LiveWire, magician Penn Jillette, who lost over 100 pounds, on why he doesn't give out diet advice.
Well, if you get medical advice from a Las Vegas magician, you are an idiot and you deserve to die.
All that and more this week on LiveWire from PRI.
Join us Saturday night at 5 on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I am KCPW producer Roger McDonough, joined this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's Kathy Stevenson, Dan Harry, Lee Davidson, and Paul Raleigh. Listeners, you can join us with your comments and questions by calling 355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255, or by commenting at sltrib.com. Kathy Stevenson, the new Eccles Theater in downtown Salt Lake City has been kind of testing things before they open in a couple of weeks' time, and they realized that they might run afoul of the law if they don't make an architectural change to their space. And this is something that restaurants grapple with a lot here in Salt Lake City and in Utah, but there's a twist to this one. Tell us about the Zion ceiling.
Yes, I like to say the Zion curtain has reached new heights.
Oh, I like
at
it.
The Eccles Center. Yeah. The Eccles Center isn't open yet, but the restaurant, the Encore Bistro that's located in the lobby, was set to open September 19th. And they had a liquor license, but to kind of officially be able to use it, the DABC had to come in and kind of check everything out and make sure everything worked and was according to the laws. And the restaurant has the required little room that with the 7-foot high barriers, the Zion curtain.
Right. And this is from a 2009 law.
The 2009 say. Law that's been in effect for all new restaurants who want to serve liquor.
Okay.
So they had it. But when the DABC compliance officer went up on the balcony, they could see in.
So they could look down and see drinks being made. Well, I mean, at the time, maybe.
Well,
conceivably.
They thought they could somebody could conceivably see that.
With their opera glasses.
With their opera glasses. When we had the photographer take photos, he was like, I don't know if you could really see if somebody was in there. But nonetheless, the DABC said you need to put a ceiling over this little room that's about as big as a cubicle. Hmm. Now, the Eccles Center has been in the works for years,
right.
And it's a multi-million dollar project that is supposedly state-of-the-art and one of the best in the country. And then all of a sudden, 3 weeks before it's supposed to open, now the architects are having to come back and put this ceiling.
I mean, and so businesses...
At public expense.
Right? At public expense. I don't know how much it will be. I don't know how strange it will look. The restaurant was able to open. They just aren't using their liquor license. So you can go in. The people with the food and beverage director believes it'll be up when the grand opening happens on October 21st.
And any complaints are they complaining that they have to do this, or are they just complying with the law?
They are complying with the law.
Okay.
You have to comply with the DABC.
So the intent, there have been efforts in the past to try and get rid of the Zion curtain, legislative attempts. A lot of businesses have said this is an undue burden to have to build this thing. Or if you have an extant business and have to add it, I guess if you're building from the scratch. It's not
that's one of the complaints, because it's inconsistent. If you had a restaurant with a liquor license before 2009, you don't have to build the Zion curtain. So it's just new restaurants coming in.
Okay.
So it's confusing to diners, because some do and some don't. Tourists don't get it. Like, why can't I see you mixing my drink?
It's to make it mysterious, more mysterious. No, I'm kidding.
The laws, to shield patrons from seeing the mixing of drinks. That's what the law says. So there's also the critics who say there's no scientific evidence based, where is the evidence that says this actually keeps people from overconsumption or underage drinking, And then businesses say it's expensive. It adds a cost that a new business who, sometimes doesn't have a lot of money, it's an extra expense that they...
Are there any other Zion ceilings anywhere? Is this the only one that you know of?
The DABC told me they had not done one before, but I did hear from Porcupine Grill up at the University of Utah, who said they had to do something similar because their stairs didn't go over the bar. So they had to do some sort of little adjustment.
I'm imagining a coffee table book of Zion ceilings coming out in the future. Yeah. But so we are stuck, I guess, with both the curtains and the ceilings for the time being. I mean, this is how it is here.
Unless somebody, I mean, I guess unless there's an uprising among restaurants and patrons, okay, and they can, I mean, it does kind of make Utah look strange, you know, so...
Well, we'll see if lawmakers take it up again ever. Well, speaking of the DABC, Kathy, the annual state audit of the agency came out this past week. And in a nutshell, I guess the sort of theme of the audit was changes could be made at the DABC.
Yes. It wasn't an audit that was required because something, you know, suspicious had happened. It was just an annual audit that they do every year. You know, they looked at all sorts of things, warehousing and how clerks' time is spent. And they also looked at salaries, mm-hmm, which has been a big subject. I think for years people have known, you know, DABC clerks don't get paid enough money. A lot of them, you know, have to, this is their second job because they can't afford to do this. So they, the auditor looked at two different groups of people who with similar jobs. They looked at convenience store clerks. And the Utah clerks make more than you would at a 7-Eleven or a Maverick.
Right.
And then they looked at salaries in other control states, and we are significantly lower than those. Hmm. So the DABC Commission was kind of saying, what, you know, do we really want to just only have clerks who can check ID and scan, or do we want to have clerks who are educated and can help customers and offer suggestions?
Right, who understand the product they're selling. The quote from your article that I think maybe caught a lot of people's eye and definitely caught my eye was from State Auditor John Dougal, who said that there are opportunities for the legislature to untie the hands of the DABC and let it perform more like the private sector and less like government. Probably not privatization of liquor sales in Utah, but maybe some reforms.
I don't think you'll ever see that, but I do think there is a push. Lawmakers, all sorts of people have been asking for them to treat the DABC more like a retail business. Senator Karen Maine has asked, you know, let's tie the department's budget, make it a percent of the budget. So instead of the legislature just kind of deciding what the budget is, you know, if the DABC keeps making more money, they'll get a percentage of that, and they can use that to hire more employees, pay better salaries, do more training.
Maybe manage their own in-house
manage it more properly, yes.
Okay. Well, I'm sure it's something that you will continue to keep an eye on. And just listeners, call us with your thoughts. We're at 801-355-TALK or comment at sltrib.com. We're actually running pretty low on time, and I don't want to miss out on the opportunity to turn to Lee Davidson's reporting on the Utah Transit Authority. And so first, Lee, the transit agency's chairman resigned the day before yesterday, on Wednesday. This is former LDS presiding Bishop H. David Burton. Why did he step down?
Well, a couple of reasons. He was recently named chairman of the Board of Trustees at the University of Utah. He said he really couldn't chair both boards well, and so he wanted to step down from UTA. But he had also said for weeks that he suspected that the governor would not reappoint him to the board. And sure enough, Governor Herbert instead appointed his former lieutenant governor, Greg Bell, to replace Burton on the board.
And Governor Herbert has had some criticism of Burton in recent weeks, especially in UTA's ongoing difficulties to sort of be transparent when it comes to its meetings. Is that correct?
That's correct. Burton's kind of been at the center of a storm for the last 2 years on a number of controversies, ranging from high salaries to a lot of executive travel internationally to sweetheart deals for developers. He passed a lot of reform dealing with those, but then he himself got caught in another controversy over secretive meetings. Hmm. At one point, he wanted to close the committee meetings that the board has. He said there wouldn't be any votes, so he thought they could do that. And at one point, he also said he wanted them closed because he didn't like the Tribune's reporting of them. Under pressure from Herbert and others, he reversed course and said, well, these meetings will be open. What he didn't say is they haven't had any of those meetings in the last 4 months. And another board member a week ago let slip that his old committee met. They had a conference call. He said all of the members but one were on this conference call. There was no public meeting notice posted, and it appeared that they were violating their vow. But that board member, his name is Charles Henderson, said, well, we disbanded our committee. So this wasn't really a committee, even though it was all of our old members. And so we didn't break our vow. This week, he changed his story and said, well, I misspoke. There were only three members on that committee. I didn't actually know who was invited to be on that call. Staff did it. So, gee, we didn't break our vow either. Amid all of that controversy, you know, the Salt Lake County Council was threatening to block some funding. They backed off.
Okay, wonderful. So this is they backed off and they're not going to get rid of the funding for.
It sounds like it, but they kind of put them on notice that we're watching you. UTA is vowing to be open, but they said their committee still aren't meeting and they're trying to look at how to restructure things.
You know, so, you know, H. David Burton steps down. We're talking about this struggle to be transparent. In the past, the agency has come under fire for things like executive salaries. Is any of that part of H. David Burton's resignation on Wednesday?
We don't know. Again, he said it's because of his chairmanship up at the U. But he has been under some fire. And while he had passed some other reforms, UTA found ways around some of those, too, that have come under criticism. They had vowed to make them reveal the board was supposed to vote on any international travel, but then there was a trip to Switzerland by some former board members that was paid by outside groups that were largely contributors to UTA. The former UTA president had a trip scheduled to Japan. When the Tribune asked about it, the trip was canceled. You know, it had not been approved by the board either. UTA said the Trib's inquiry had nothing to do with the cancellation. So they keep having some problems about openness. And when the governor made his appointment of Bell, he used a lot of wording about how Bell can inspire public trust and is reliable and a good person to help move trust of that agency forward.
Former Lieutenant Governor who was head of the Utah Hospital Association and is now making the move to UTA. Paul Raleigh, transit obviously is, you know, an important part of getting people from point A to point B. This is how it happens here in our area, and we need a transit authority like UTA doing what it does, the good work that it can do. But there are, you know, all of these questions that occasionally shine a kind of difficult light on the agency.
You know, all I can say about the UTA is having, you know, reading Lee's stories over the last few years is like reading one of those old soap opera-like serials that newspapers used to run a century ago. It's just one bizarre, weird thing after another. And, you know, they close their meetings, they open their meetings, they don't have committees anymore, and everything else. It goes back years, and Lee has covered this very well. But, you know, back in the days on some of the site selections for Front Runner and the controversies over that. And it's led to a push by a lot of people to have the UTA board elected rather than appointed because these appointments are political appointments. The board members are chosen by various entities, in the county. And it normally is, I mean, it's usually very political. And so maybe that's one of the reasons why you have all the situations that you have.
Lee Davidson, any chance that we could see elected, that happening, of UTA's board being elected?
There's always a chance. There's some talk that the legislature is considering a bill, or some legislators are considering that. There's a group that is called the Utah Transit Riders Union. It's a group of riders that take transit. They're calling for election of the board. I don't know. I kind of doubt it, but we'll see.
You'll see. Okay, movements afoot, and maybe, you know, listeners, we are low on time. There's so much we didn't actually get to. Kathy Stevenson's reporting. There was some food truck stories that we didn't get to. Also, the story of Salt Lake County Recorder Gary Ott. Maybe we can save that for our underplayed stories of the week, which we have to turn to now. And Lee Davidson, do you have an underplayed story for this week?
Oh, I'll go with the theft of two signs in southern Utah. Oh, yeah. For what used to be called Negro Bill Canyon. BLM tried to change the name of the trailhead to Grandstaff. Right. There was a man named William Grandstaff, who was black, who was a rancher and prospector in the area in the past century, well, in the 1870s. And the original name was a much more nastier name, but it was changed to Negro Bill in the 30s. And this just kind of shows that I think people don't like the move to be more politically correct. You could see it in the Trump campaign.
Well, I know that, Janetta Williams from the NAACP had actually advocated for the maintaining the name Negro Bill Canyon, if I remember correctly from reporting in the Tribune, because of the idea of preserving that history. It's an interesting an interesting story. Kathy Stevenson, do you have an underplayed story of the week?
Well, I'll just say this weekend is a conference for the Mormon Church, and the Salt Lake Tribune had a tab that ran in Sunday, and if you didn't see it, you should go pull it out because there's some really thoughtful, great stories, and I'm just going to point to one that our health reporter, Alex Stuckey, wrote about some counseling that couples are getting, and I think that is worth looking into.
It is an interesting story as well. Paul Raleigh, underplayed story of the week.
Yeah, I'll just talk about, mention the school board races. You know, that's always underplayed. That always gets little attention according to, compared to other political races. But it's very important. This year, you're seeing a stark contrast in a lot of these races between candidates who are more, want more toward privatization, more toward, you know, more computers and that sort of thing. In the schools provided by private contractors and that sort of thing, against board or candidates who are more traditional, more supportive of public education, public school teachers.
Teachers in general, yeah, as opposed to teachers versus technology sometimes is the way it's broken down. Okay, Paul Raleigh. And Dan Harry, for you, your underplayed story of the week, do you have
one? I'm going to pick a story that was written by Peggy Fletcher Stack from a poll that we did, recent poll, that showed that while we hear tremendous amount of talk from LDS church leaders and from elected leaders in Utah about religious liberty and how it's under attack, they talk about it constantly. Very few Utahns list that as a top issue in the state. The number for the overall population is about 3% list that as a top issue. And even among LDS folks and voters in Utah, that's a very, it looks like a low priority issue for them.
A disconnect between lawmakers and voters there.
Yeah.
Oh, that's
what a shock.
Yeah, what a shock. It seems like a common enough theme. Well, for my underplayed story of the week, I'm going to go with KCPW is in the midst of its fall pledge drive, and we would love for you to make contributions to allow our print and radio partnership. This Salt Lake Tribune program is made possible by listeners. Give us a call and make your pledges of support or give at kcpw.org. I know that Utah Public Radio in Logan is also somewhere around its fundraising season. Guys, I'm not positive. And please give to them as well. Listeners, we do appreciate all that you do for public radio. Dan Harry, Lee Davidson, Paul Raleigh, and Kathy Stevenson, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Roger.
Thank you.
Thanks to Jesse Ellis at KCPW, Tom Williams at and Connor Rivers at Utah Public Radio, and the Tribune's Emily Means. That does it for this edition of Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. You can find us on Facebook at KCPW-FM or on Twitter. We are at KCPW. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks again for tuning in this morning and have a great weekend.
What do women and girls living in and then leaving their polygamous communities have in common with an engineer from San Francisco who rocked and rolled with a group of girls from Cache Valley? We were curious. Are you? Well then, stay tuned to Utah Public Radio during the month of October, where we will share their stories and others from Utah organizations working to empower people who are objectified. During a UPR special program series, Objectified: More Than a Body, we'll air their stories and others here on Utah Public Radio, helping to enlighten our communities about ways to look beyond someone's body image. An original Utah Public Radio series in partnership with the Utah Women's Giving Circle, Utah State University Center for Women and Gender, and Utah Public Radio.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Cache Valley Center for the Arts, presenting the Olathe Dogs, a theatrical canine act with doggy stunts and tricks, and Human Acrobats, with Richard Olathe and his son Nicholas, Monday, October 17th at 7:30 p.m. Details at cacharts.org. This is Utah Public Radio, a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences, KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSUFM Logan, also heard at upr.org.